Hello and welcome to the Poppin' Bottles Dadcast. I'm Ben. No Nick this time around on this very special episode because Nick's not cool enough to be here.
But I am. Not.
But you are. My lovely mother. Heroic raiser of three boys. Well, let me tell you, our pieces of work.
You guys were wonderful. I was so lucky to have you for a son.
I get to do like an official. Hold on, this is where the official NPR voice is at. Nancy Mullen, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you, Ben Mullen. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, you know, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah. Yes, it has.
It's one of those things where every Mother's Day. Well, it'll start coming up, and Nick and I'll be like, you know, we should really have our moms on the podcast. And then everything just falls apart from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I would remind you and Nick about how, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon took their moms to the Oscars.
Exactly.
But I'll settle for sitting in my dining room talking.
As soon as I go to the Oscars or the SAG Awards or whatever.
I'm going
to
be there.
You're there. No, don't even worry about it.
With a big old sign on my chest that says, I am Ben's mom.
Well, okay, so there's the show that Emma, like, loves to watch. Liv and Maddie, right?
Uh-huh.
And, there are some really deep parallels to members of our family, right? Like, for instance, the way that it's about a pair of twins, and sometimes the faces that they make mm-hmm. and the way they interact with each other reminds me a lot of Claire and V.
Yes.
But then there's this one joke that they dropped during an episode. Where the one daughter is talking about like pressure while she's playing a basketball game because she's big into basketball. She's like, I got all this pressure going on for me, and my ex-boyfriend's in the stands, and my mom's on the sidelines yelling, she came out of my womb with a basketball! I was like, that's something mom would say. You know?
Well, it's not surprising. I, you know, tell the story all the time about how when I was pregnant with your brother, Ian, that I had cravings for nothing but Chinese food and Mexican food.
Right.
And how it was a little weird, not weird, but, you know, surprising, mm-hmm. that he came out with olive-colored skin, black eyes, black hair, and ended up studying to be a chef.
Well, what you're saying is you were concerned at first.
Your father was.
Right. But yeah, you know, stuff that happens in the womb can go on to, like butterfly effect into other things. Yeah.
When I was carrying Frank, he never stopped moving.
Okay.
So,
he still has trouble.
He has not stopped moving. And you used to write passively with one finger, I think, on the inside, I think, and I thought you were going to be a writer or a football player.
Right, because I'm drawing up plans and stuff like that.
Something,
I think of it more, you know, nowadays with the path that I've gone down. There's a lot of writing involved.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's kind of just, it's mostly like a, hey, what's this thing? I think I'm going to try it, you know. So it was probably, I was in there like, oh, hey, this feels soft. What is this?
Right.
And, you know,
kind
and
of kick like you in the spleen. Hieroglyphics, and, cavemen drawing, something. Yeah.
So you have a very unique perspective. Which is one of the reasons that we've... yeah, you do. It's one of the reasons that I've always wanted to, like, have you on the podcast and talk about stuff. Because you have a perspective that not many people... At least in my generation and many people in, like, I guess Gen X generation, mm-hmm. Can really understand is what it's like to be a mom and be a woman in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming up in the time periods that you did. You know, you were growing up in the late 50s into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were a teenager in the late 60s, right?
Yep.
And then coming into, I guess, what doctors of the time would call womanhood? I don't know. adulthood. We'll just say adulthood.
We'll say womanhood, mid-60s, adulthood, early 70s.
There you go. Yeah. And then, you know, motherhood through the 80s and 90s and, you know, the different jobs that you have had over the years, you know, working for a pharmaceutical company and then, you know, working at the law offices for a little while there and, you know, that sort of thing. So one of the awesome things about me and my parents is that we have connected a lot more than most of my generation does with their parents. You know, like, a lot of them have, like, the same favorite television shows and that sort of thing. And you know, we got into that a bit. But there's always been, like, a... Like, you guys were always really keen on talking to us like adults, you know. And so we got to connect with you guys on certain levels that not a lot of people have. So I have an understanding of, you know, what it was like over those periods of time, because we've talked about that sort of thing. But you know, it's not a topic that is generally talked about right now in this period of, how should we say, tension and uncertainty.
That's a good way to put it.
In the realm of you know, being a woman and being a mother and you know, being
and
a parent,
all of that
in general.
Being under attack yet again.
Yeah. And you know, we could go into the political aspect of it, but I think it's really coming in on a fundamental basis.
Well, I just find that the time period that I was born into was extremely interesting and challenging from a discrimination standpoint. A lot of standpoints, but in particular the discrimination standpoint. I guess I'm considered mid-century. I was born in the mid-50s.
Right.
I was born post-World War II, post-Korean War, but prior to the Vietnam War.
Right.
A lot of things were going on in the world, of course. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
Sounds familiar.
The American couple who were selling secrets to the Soviets.
That's right.
That are atomic technology, and they were sentenced and executed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There, let's see, Elizabeth became queen after George VI died.
Yeah.
The polio vaccine. Hemingway published The Old Man and the Sea.
Right.
Hillary climbed Mount Everest. But most significantly, Rosa Parks, the very month I was born, month and year that I was born, was the Rosa Parks incident that we've all learned in history class about her refusing to sit on the back of the bus, and then which led to the boycott of the Alabama bus system led by Martin Luther King Jr. After my birth was the Little Rock Nine. Mm. Familiar with the Little Rock Nine?
Yeah.
So was born into this world of discrimination.
Right.
You know, when you're talking about Nazis in power and the slaughter of Jews and those who were less than 100% humans in their minds.
Right.
And the treatment of blacks.
Yeah.
In particular. What was significant in my life space was that I was lucky enough to be born white, and I was born in a lovely suburb outside of Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Upper Darby Township.
Right.
I am the product of parents who were born and raised in an area outside of Philadelphia called the Main Line. For those people who don't know what the Main Line is, it was an area of wealth and privilege that was the result of the railroad expanding outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
It is still an area of wealth and privilege, except for my parents.
Right.
They were born on what was called the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
My dad was born and raised in Gladwin. My mother was born and raised in Bryn Mawr. And being born in that area, there were certain expectations.
Right. So, and it was basically, you know, so you talk about the financial aspect, you know, right side of the tracks, wrong side of the tracks. Mm-hmm. But it seems like in that area as a whole, there were certain, even if you didn't have, you know, a certain level of wealth, mm-hmm. there were still expectations as far as
there were expectations how you handle of
yourself
of, yes.
as a society member,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
So my parents, you know, bought their first house under the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. You know, returning vets got money to buy their homes and establish their families after the war. And it's one of those things that sociologists claim helped to develop and support what they called the white flight out of the cities.
Right.
Like people running from the city atmosphere into the suburbs and building houses and having great schools and mm-hmm. living this lifestyle that the main line supported.
Yeah.
You know? So I had that privilege of being white, of living in this very comfortable neighborhood and having great schools. The Upper Darby School District was fabulous and had a reputation for producing people who were ready to go out into the world.
Right, yeah.
I had several job offers right out of high school based strictly on the fact that I was a graduate of Upper Darby.
Yeah.
With that said, however, I would have preferred to have graduated into a doctoral program.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, everything was geared from a personal standpoint and a social standpoint to my being a good wife, a good mother,
right,
a good housekeeper.
Yeah.
Things like that.
And that's one of those things, you know, that I guess that's one of the main topics that I want to, you know, want to hit on while we're having this talk, because from the perspective of, like, let's say millennials in my generation, mm-hmm. we have heard about this.
Right.
And we have read about this, but it's not something that we've experienced firsthand. And it's not something that a lot of people who went through it like to talk about, you know?
Well, everything in this life has a good side and a bad side.
Right.
In order for communities and society to be successful, there has to be a standard,
right,
I guess is a good way to put it.
I understand, yeah.
And my education from my father's perspective and my education in junior high and high school was all geared toward this goal, to be a successful human being, to be able to stand on your own feet,
mm-hmm.
to keep a house, cook your own food, manage a budget, go out into the world and work.
Which, real quick interjection, mm-hmm. since I have become a parent,
yes,
I have realized a lot more.
You should have had home economics.
Difficult, and I wish that my home ec class in my high school extended beyond learning how to sew. Because you taught me that already, and I aced it, which was great. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah, so I had a father who, for whatever reason, had his own feelings about women. Mm-hmm. Whether he was taught these things by his father or, as my mother said, he was a completely different man when he got back from the war than the man he was before he left.
Hmm.
He had some particularly stressful times.
Right, yeah.
But the message that I got from my father was that, first of all, I was born a female, which meant I had the ability to cook, clean, sew, raise children, and all that. Just because I was a female.
It's just in your blood, apparently.
Right, apparently. But on the flip side of that, men were also believed to have been born with mechanical abilities.
Right.
You know, like every dad should be able to fix a car.
Yeah, naturally strong arms.
Right.
And, yeah,
they want that green lawn, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to understand that I went through very deep personal trauma as well. At a very young age, I had a brother who committed suicide. I was only 8 years old at the time. And I saw the pain that it caused my family. And so I put it upon myself at the tender age of 8 to be perfect, to never ever give my parents anything to be concerned about, worry about.
Right.
I was to be the perfect child, the perfect student, the perfect daughter. That I imposed on myself. Female stereotypes my father imposed on me.
And stuck to,
Right.
Yeah.
And some of my education, like I said, it was a double-edged sword. We had this junior high. For those who don't know what a junior high is, that would be the equivalent to middle school these days.
Yeah.
So about the ages of 13 to 15, I'm in junior high. And everything was geared toward my learning to be a proper woman.
Right.
I had home economics class, which involved the sewing, the cooking, the household budget, how to clean an oven. Ooh, whoop-de-doo.
I'll tell you.
Clean a bathroom, make
it's
a
handy
bed.
Nowadays.
And the school actually even had an apartment in it. It had the apartment had a living room, a dining room, a kitchen, a bedroom, and a bath.
Right.
And part of your training was to take that, and every spring, the girls in the home economic class had to serve a tea for the teachers. We had to go into the apartment and make it all nice.
Make little sandwiches and stuff.
Make
like
little
that.
Sandwiches, oh, little cucumber sandwiches, and make tea and serve it and clean up afterward. And you were actually graded on your performance.
Right.
If you think about the movie A League of Their Own.
Yes.
There's that scene where they all have to go take classes on how to be ladies.
Right.
And you see them practicing how to stand up from a chair, sit in a chair.
Doing the whole book on the head thing.
The book on the head so that you have proper posture.
Right.
Absolutely. We learned all of that. That was part of our training.
Yeah.
Women of our mother's generation didn't generally wear pants at home.
Yeah.
They wore house dresses, which was basically like a robe that snapped down the front.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you wore during the day when you did your household chores. And then by the time Dad got home from work, you were in your dress with your pearl necklace and your little pumps. And usually, you know, had a drink on the table next to his favorite chair with his pipe and his slippers. And how was your day, darling?
Yeah.
Children were seen but not heard.
Right.
The kids had to be clean and the house clean when he came through the door. On the other hand, in defense of, you know, this generation, Upper Darby was very forward-thinking as well because the boys had to take home economics.
There you go.
For it was only half a semester, but they had to learn to sew or they had to learn how to cook. And the girls got to take woodworking. Or electric shop.
Okay.
I took woodworking, man. I made some badass bookends. I'm telling you. I was very proud.
You know what? Now that you've said that, I know where I get it from now.
Exactly.
I have a thing for bookends.
There you go.
Damn it.
But this junior high also was run by what I believe to be a Nazi. Charles Burke.
Well,
evil man. One of the things that really got me, because I walked to school, uphill both ways,
Right, yeah.
I showed you the hill.
Uphill both ways in the snow.
I drove you and showed you the hill. We were not allowed to wear pants.
Right.
Girls were not allowed to wear pants. Skirts had to be a certain length.
Right.
Your bra couldn't be showing under any circumstances. The only time that they made an exception was if the weather was particularly bad, you were allowed to wear pants until you reached the first bathroom in the hallway. And then you had to change your clothes before you went to your homeroom.
Hmm.
And the girls' guidance counselor would be standing in the hallway watching everyone.
Yeah.
Your father was forced to wear a tie to school.
Right.
But then again, we're talking about your father, who pointed out that the school handbook did not require where he wore the tie on his body. So he would just tie a tie anywhere on his body.
Which is why I think he got along so well with my buddy John Zeitz. Because, because John Zeitz got in trouble once for not wearing a belt with his pants because his pants would start to fall down. But he didn't feel like going out and getting a belt. Or asking his parents for one. So he grabbed a tie, like, just an extra long necktie.
Right.
And, I mean, he was a skinny dude to begin with.
Right.
And he just threaded it through his jeans and tied it. He says, like, look, now I'm more formal than even you are.
Yeah. But there, my parents never taught me discrimination.
Mm.
That was not in our household. But the other dads in the neighborhood, you know, the neighborhood was primarily Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, like I said, who had escaped West Philadelphia or South Philadelphia and gone to the suburbs.
Right.
They brought with them quite a bit of discrimination.
Yeah.
And there were several things that saved me from that. First of all, my parents. They didn't teach me to think that way.
Yeah.
But also, thank whatever powers it be, black comedians.
Yeah.
On my television.
Yeah.
Black music on my radio station.
Right.
Motown played a huge part in my life.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing about, you know, your generation as well, and coming up in that time period, because, you know, like, it's something that not a lot of us really recognize, or at least it took me a while to recognize this. So there's a time period where you have, you know, very white male macho people like mm-hmm. Ernest Hemingway.
Right.
Who's still putting stuff out and influencing the times in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still there at the same time as Sammy Davis Jr. is coming
right.
up. And Motown hits the scene, you know,
right.
that sort of thing.
Right.
So it was a very interesting, like, blend of, I guess you would call pop culture.
But it was very strange to be hanging out at the street corner with my little transistor radio listening to Wibbage.
Right.
You know, who played Motown.
Yeah.
And all of these fabulous black singers and musicians and people and then go home and turn on the evening news and watch these very same people being assaulted.
Right.
With fire hoses and batons and told that they can't be in this building. You can't sleep in this room in this hotel. You can't walk these streets. You can't drink out of this water fountain. You can't attend this school.
Yeah.
It was just so bizarre. Then here I go transition. You know, I'm transitioning from junior high, which I tell you that the guy was a Nazi. and then I go into the high school. And it's freedom.
Right.
It is absolute freedom for me because in the high school, they didn't care.
You could wear jeans.
I could wear the lowest pair of hip huggers on my what used to be really thin frame. And I could go braless in a halter top to class.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody said anything. Not
right.
the teachers, no one. Except, you know, a few boys who were rude, crude, and socially
right.
unacceptable.
And probably some of your older brothers were like, you're going to school like that?
My brothers didn't care.
No, they didn't. Okay.
My brothers didn't. They were in a world. You have to realize that there is 13 years between me and my oldest brother.
That's right, yeah.
So he was in college
yeah,
when
was
I
in
was
college
in elementary
already.
School.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then my other brothers were in high school when I was in junior high.
Gotcha.
So, they, you know, I was just a baby sister. I was a
right.
annoyance.
Oh, the youngest. You know?
Yeah, but So, you know, everyone's heard the stories about how Sammy Davis Jr. was allowed to perform in hotels, but he wasn't allowed to sleep in the hotels.
Right.
You know, things like that. So it was a weird, weird situation out there.
Right.
And it really, and I give a lot of credit, too, like I said, the black comedians of the time and the musicians. I'm sorry that Bill Cosby is going through what he's going through now, but his comedy was genius to me.
Right.
Because as a kid, he made every kid in the nation the same. Didn't matter
yeah.
what you were. You all did double dutch in the street. You played street football. You
mm-hmm.
had the same fears and concerns.
Yeah.
And he vocalized all of that so well in a way that was
yeah.
just so hysterically funny. Watching Flip Wilson on TV.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. He was fabulous.
Who,
fabulous.
Wayne Brady reminds me a lot of Flip Wilson.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I wish he was doing more game show stuff. That sort of thing.
But anyway, there was really no black people in our neighborhood.
Right.
Growing up. And that was intentional. I mean, at that time, real estate agents were actually allowed, you know, to not show a house to a black family or a minority family, right, if yeah. it was in a predominantly white neighborhood. The only teacher at Upper Darby High School at that time, there was one black teacher at that time, Mr. Carter, taught English. Mm-hmm. Fabulous guy, wonderful teacher. Our groups, if there were gangs at all, they were based on where your parents came from.
Right.
If you were Polish, if you were Greek, if you, you know,
and probably a lot
Italian
of the whole, new money, old money.
New money, old money, definitely. Yeah, yeah. The prosperity of post-World War II right. had a lot to do with it. Gang fights, if they were gang fights at all, never took place on or near school property. I could walk anywhere and be safe. I could go into any building right. and be safe. My local butcher, my local hardware store, my high school, my junior high, no one messed with kids, mm-hmm. no matter what your age was. Yeah. It wasn't allowed and was considered so far out of the norm, nobody would think of bringing a gun to school.
Right.
So it's a very safe and fabulous environment to be raised in, but it had its challenges.
Right.
So between my father's telling me that, you know, and he did tell me very specifically that I was stupid mm-hmm. because I was female.
Right.
He told me that I would never amount to anything beyond being a good wife and a mother because I was female.
Right.
College was not an option. He never had the money to send any of us to college anyway. But in particular, he was very direct with me about never getting to go to college.
Right.
In Upper Darby, you selected your classes before you started, and there were two tracks. That's what they called them. You were either college track or you were business track.
Right.
And I wanted to be college track. I really wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I wanted to specialize in genetics. That was my interest. But my father decided that I should learn how to take shorthand
mm-hmm.
and how to type and office classes, how to work in office,
right?
Be a secretary. He also thought I should learn French, play the piano, but I'm terrible at languages and we couldn't afford a piano. So,
right.
But other people recognized that I had talents beyond that. In fact, my guidance counselor, the one that used to check the length of my skirts and whether my bra was showing, when she saw the paperwork that my father had filled out, she called me into her office and she said, is this really what you want to do? I mean, your grades in math and science are excellent.
Yeah.
Don't you have any aspirations to do more than this? And I said, well, yes, I do,
mm-hmm.
but my father won't allow me.
Right.
And because of the pressures I put on myself to be the perfect child and never upset my parents, I just accepted it all.
Right.
So then high school was very freeing for me from that standpoint, and there was a shift a bit in feminism then. You talk about the way my mother would dress, you know, in the pearls and the, you know, have the martini ready and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For the women of the 70s, there came this attitude where the pendulum started to swing the other way, which said, you know what? You really ought to judge me by my brains.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go braless,
right.
and I'm going to put on a few pounds, and I'm not going to wear any makeup, and you're just going to have to put up with it.
Right.
I'm still the same person that I am, and if you don't like it, tough.
Yeah.
You know? Women actually started to, and it, you know, how this pendulum swings sometimes, women started actually getting vicious about it.
Yeah.
I remember sometimes when, if you tried dolling yourself up, as we called it, you were seen as less than a perfect mother.
Right.
If you put on pounds and you didn't wear makeup, that's because you were putting all your energy into raising your children and
yeah.
not being vain and putting it on yourself, you know, dressing yourself up all the time.
Right.
It was an outward evidence of you're putting your family ahead of you.
Right. It's kind of in the same vein, you know, just to put it into perspective for some people. There's a really popular thing going around Facebook right now. It's mm-hmm. about a Japanese thing where if you fall asleep at work,
mm-hmm.
it's okay because that means that you're working hard.
Right.
You know? Right. So it's almost like if you're the type of person, like a lot of, you know, parents and people who just work in general, right. if you're the type of person where you're, you know, up early in the morning, work all day,
right.
and then only rest at night, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, you're putting too much energy into one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get you.
So the aspects of, in particular, you know, being told that because I was born female, I had certain skills.
Yeah.
As a child, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, I was expected to do the laundry. Right. I was expected to clean the house. I was expected to clean the bathrooms. I was expected to know how to cook, even though I had absolutely no instruction on how to cook at that point. I was my mother's right hand, especially in medical matters. Mm-hmm. My father had his first heart attack at 39.
Wow.
Had several operations for the almost 40-some kidney stones that he had. And I was responsible, as a child, to do his dressings.
Yeah.
You know, take the bandages off, clean them, put clean bandages on. I have distinct memories of having to hold my 17, 18-year-old brother down on the bed physically while my mother shoved anti-seizure medication into his face because he didn't want to take his meds.
Right.
This was all plus I was supposed to shine all of their shoes. Right. One of my jobs was to polish my dad's shoes and all of my brother's shoes, spit polish.
Right.
So putting all of that together,
yeah,
you know, and I come into the 70s as, you know, a young adult woman, and I have poured myself into learning how to be the best secretary I could possibly be.
Right.
It's paid off in some ways. I was able to support myself and support your oldest brother, you know, when I went through my divorce, and be productive. Mm-hmm. And I was good at it to the point where now I still have bosses that I had back in the late 70s and early 80s who were my friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
John Lauer.
Yeah. Shout out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was really good at it, but I did put a lot of pressure on myself to be perfect. And I've taken a lot of criticism over the years, and I still take criticism from some people who are close to me about, oh, well, you're an overprotective mother, or you're, you know, you should let your kids get out there and, you know. Well, I'm sorry, but I had particular challenges with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Frank was the product of a divorce, and it was a nasty divorce. And so it became my biggest worry whether or not he would walk back through the door every time you went on a visitation with his father.
Yeah.
Ian was very ill most of his life, life-threatening ill.
Yeah.
And I had to really educate myself on, and, you know, dad's depression issues and, mm-hmm. you know, all of that, moving a lot because of his job.
And I was a prick.
No, you were wonderful.
No, it's okay.
You were.
It's fine. I have reflected long and hard on my teenage life. And, you know, I can't say that I regret anything, but, yeah, I could have been better to people, including you guys.
Everybody experiments, and every child is a challenge in his own way. But you guys kept your challenges to a minimum, which I totally appreciate. But my approach to parenting from all of this standpoint that I've explained, I got to the point where, all right, I'm stupid. So I have to go find people who know what they're talking about. And so I would come up with an issue and I would go to 25 different people, if that's what it took, and say, have you ever had this experience? What did you do about it? What do you know? Doctors, lawyers, I don't care who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I asked the questions, and then I dissected the information, and I applied it the best way that I could to the situation at home.
Yeah.
I think I was pretty successful.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so.
And, you know, I hope that you can reflect back on that, you know, despite the fact that you had this, you know, this notion that you were stupid, so to speak, you were significantly smarter than a lot of people, because most people would not have done that. They would have tried to stick with what they knew,
mm-hmm.
and if they happened to come across a solution, then great. Then,
right.
I mean, it's basically a matter of good luck. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, you were smart enough to know who to seek out and talk to and to learn about these things, and
mm-hmm.
you know.
And it was legitimate. The whole intelligence discussion was legitimate to a certain extent from my father's standpoint, if you can take this twisted way of looking at it. But my brothers were all geniuses. I mean, documented geniuses. You know, when your brother comes home and says, "Hey, now I'm a member of Mensa," you know,
it's
there. It's you know, they're walking around with their National Honor Society stuff, and I just got this and that and other things.
But you know, it's a product of how they were treated as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, because they were given that empowerment that you weren't given.
They were given the ability and the encouragement to go to college. And to get a better education and pursue something that interested them.
Right.
I didn't get to go to college until I was in my 50s. My goal changed. When I wanted to go to college in junior high, I wanted to be a doctor, a legitimate doctor. When I got in my 50s and I actually got to go to college for a little while, my goal was to stomp all over my brothers. I just wanted to get a doctorate of any form and throw it in their faces.
Right, yeah.
And I did. I proved that I was smart on that scale. I, myself, National Honor Society, you know, got the pin and everything. But mothering and parenting my parents won out.
Mm-hmm.
My father was very ill. My mother became very ill and became a widow. So the responsibility of watching over them was on me. And so I left school. I left the full-time job that I had at the school, everything,
mm-hmm.
and went to take care of my parents.
Yeah.
It was particularly tough. One night we were living, where were we living? North Jersey, I think. And I had to get in the car. It was Christmas Eve. And I had to get in the car and drive from North Jersey down to my mother because my mother needed me.
Yeah.
And as I'm driving to my mother, I see your brother Frank pass me in the opposite lane because he was heading home. He was already in the military then and mm-hmm. was heading home because he had some time and I wasn't going to get to see him.
Right, yeah.
You know?
So. Well, we have to wrap up this episode.
Okay.
But we will do a part two.
I'm so excited about that.
We have plenty more to talk about. But, you know, I know you're stubborn like my father.
No, really?
So, yeah. but I will tell you that, you know, it's something that I have always reflected on and thought about as I've, you know... come to learn more over the years about the kind of life that you have had since, you know, childhood, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope that you can reflect on it in the same way, and that, you know, it is incredibly difficult to come from the type of place that you came from and deal with all the things that you have had to deal with.
But it could have been so much worse.
It could have been
if
so
I had
much
been
true.
Born black
right.
or Mexican, or right. it could have been
or in another
so
country
much worse.
That you know had a coup. There's so many coups,
yeah.
over the past, you know,
but
50 some years. But I hope that you can, you know, reflect on all the things that you have accomplished, including family life and raising sons.
I have the greatest sons on the planet. I'm telling you,
and it's your fault. You know that,
and
right?
And my grandchildren? Oh, could go on for hours about my grandchildren. And that is the function of all of this, is to create this circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You have a household. You get educated. You do what needs to be done to be a productive person in your house, in your neighborhood, your larger community, your nation,
and
your
within
world.
Yourself, within
and
your
within
own
yourself.
Mind.
And,
yeah.
And while it was, you know, Dad, you know, there was a lot of question, you know, conversations like that. Dad!
Yeah.
But he was right sometimes, and I have to, I have to admit that. And my mother was right sometimes.
You know, I think the only, from my perspective anyway, the only credit that I can really give to a person who had that kind of perspective on life,
mm-hmm.
the, you know, you should learn French, you should learn piano, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think the only credit that I could possibly give to that is that that's what society as a whole demanded of, you know, you and ladies of your generation, and preparing you for that in that way, I think helped in you becoming, you know, coming out of high school and doing that sort of, you know, doing that sort of work and living that sort of life to an extent, while you set up for further success beyond the parameters of their.
In my grandparents' generation, who were all immigrants, having a balanced education was absolutely vital to your success. Every child was basically learned how to play the piano, play the violin, read. Literature was huge. Art was huge. And just about any personality that you study, you know, look at the Marx Brothers, look at, you know, their mothers or someone in their neighborhood sat them down at the piano. So you will learn the piano. You will learn to appreciate this, that. And there was an education across the board, and it wasn't a bad thing.
Right.
And it's one of the things that we bemoan about current education, that our kids should still, our grandkids should still be studying art, studying music.
You know? Like I said, my home ec class was basically just sewing. Would it kill you to teach me how to do my taxes?
Like, and maybe something. Next time we'll talk about how I taught 150 freshman college students to use a sewing machine.
Exactly. All right, so that's going to do it for part one, and we're moving on to part two shortly. All right, cool stuff. Thanks for listening, guys.